Welcome to Advancement Daily's interview series. Today, I welcome internationally recognized annual giving consultant and case laureate Bob Burdinsky. He's the author of three case bestsellers in the recently published Online Innovations in Annual and Regular Giving, 10 Dozen Departures That Worked, which is the first case book to ever be translated into Mandarin and published in China. Bob is a 10-time faculty member of the annual Case Europe Spring Institute in Educational Fundraising, and a perennial presenter of CASE's regular giving masterclasses in the UK, and presented CASE's first ever regular giving programs in Japan, India, Australia, New Zealand, Hong Kong, Ireland, and Singapore. He is also a recipient of the CASE Crystal Apple Award for his excellence in educating and entertaining his audiences. Prior to consulting, Bob spent 22 years in fundraising. He served as the Director of Annual Giving and then Director of University Advancement at Cleveland State University, Vice President for Development at Catholic Charities Corporation, and Chief Development Officer at Notre Dame College of Ohio. Thank you so much for joining me today, Bob. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
It's a pleasure to be here, John. I'm sorry we've now run out of time, but thanks for the opportunity.
Well, Bob, for someone with such a long legacy in fundraising, that was about as short of an introduction as I can manage, but not trying to age you anymore, but especially when you first started, fundraising was not a traditional occupation, even in higher education, or at the very least, the profession hadn't been widely formalized. How did you get started, and why did you stick with it?
Well, that question completely ages me, just to clarify, but it is an accurate framing of my background in that. So I went to Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, great place to go to school. And I joined a student organization that today we would sort of call the Student Alumni Association. Back then it was the Miami University Student Foundation, a pretty highbrow name for it. But the cool thing about it was that was the group that got to give the campus tours and would go on road shows to promote the university to high school audiences. And, you know, you got to wear a red blazer a lot. It was pretty selective. So it really was a cool thing to be part of. And it introduced me to the world of advancement in general, and education advancement in particular. One of the things they asked us to do in the organization one year was to voluntarily come and call Miami alumni and ask them for a gift. And this was really when phone-a-thons were just getting started. They didn't pay us. We did it for free. I joke that because we were so bad, it dawned on somebody to pay the good kids to do it, and that would be worth it. So it was all very kind of embryonic. And you're exactly right, even though I'm making fun, that there was not a clear development career path like there quickly emerged once we had paid students who we could then offer jobs to when they were graduating, and you could just march up the advancement career ladder that way. But I did graduate from Miami with an accounting degree, believe it or not, but bit with the bug about what all of us do in advancement and came home. If you really want me to date myself, I'll tell you that I came home with my diploma and started looking at the want ads in the newspaper for mostly accounting jobs, but also saw development jobs and talked my way into a job at a Catholic high school in Cleveland, Ohio. And then the path kind of emerged from there, you know, a bigger school and then a university and then a bigger university, Catholic Charities, like you mentioned, and then onward upward. So, and why did I stick with it? I think the reason a lot of the folks in our work do, because we love championing good causes. And I had a lot of friends at Miami who graduated with marketing degrees and were promoting this bank or this roll of toilet paper. And, you know, it was all perfectly legitimate work, but I kind of enjoyed the additional gratification of promoting a good cause, you know, whether it was Catholic Charities or higher education or whatever. I sort of feel like we get to scratch more than one itch in our work. And so I've never looked back. I've thoroughly enjoyed every minute of it. That's my origin.
Well, Miami University was certainly ahead of its time, and the exposure they gave you seemed to be very invaluable for your career. And I believe every higher education organization and most nonprofits in Europe and in Asia are very pleased that you stuck with this profession and wanted to scratch more than one itch, and you were able to do so. But you dabbled in higher education, you dabbled in religious organizations. So can you compare the two for us? What are the differences you experienced working in those two different types of nonprofit organizations?
Well, it's funny, both kind of have built-in advantages, don't they? So, at a university or a school has their alumni or their parents, and they can really talk to those audiences in a way that most other organizations can't. And the church is very much the same way, right? When you can invoke the deity in why you should support a cause or charitable works and things like that. So similar but different. In at Catholic Charities, you were very much talking to everybody who was sitting in the pew in church on Sundays and doing the appeal envelopes and all that stuff, and very gratifying work, I should say too. Sort of keeping people familiar with all the human services work that was going on with the church. And then a university is very similar too, in that you can talk to your constituent audience about their classmates and their reunion and their children on campus in a way that a lot of other places can't. So it's been nice at both types of institutions to have a little bit of a built-in affinity. I'm sometimes very envious of our colleagues at other kinds of not-for-profits who really have to devote a lot of their energy just to identifying who their audiences are. I have a whole lot of respect for how they're able to do that. So I don't know if that's just because I've preferred the easier access to audiences or what, but my career has tended to be with institutions that the target prospects aren't all that hard to identify, right? We just need to go and engage them.
Well, it sounds like there's not that many differences between higher education organizations and religious organization fundraising, in particular, how you identify your target audience and cultivate them. But moving on in your career, someone at Case saw you and thought you were pretty good at what you do. What has been your experience working with Case, and how has that impacted your view of philanthropy?
Well, I hope somebody at Case doesn't regret identifying me, because they sure have given me plenty of opportunities, and I like to say I've made a nuisance of myself with Case over the years. So back again, to go back to your painful question about how long ago I started in the business. When I was a boy in annual giving, Case was really a very singular resource. This, and I'm embarrassed to say, this even goes back to before the internet, and so Case used to print a directory. It was like a small-sized phone book, and every 2 years this directory would come out, and that used to be the only way to really know who did what you do in our profession. So if I wanted to know who the annual giving director was at any other university around the country, I would run for the Case directory and literally start going page by page looking for annual giving, annual giving, annual giving. So Case was fundamental just in building a network for yourself in the business. And then Case conferences, no surprise, were just about the only professional development opportunity that was out there. I mean, now every Tom, Dick, and Harry, including me, Bob, can offer webinars and master class days and things like that. But Case was the only tree in the forest. So that drew me and everybody else to Case, and it was really a point of pride if you ever presented at a Case program. So I learned that I had a little bit of an ability up in front of a crowd, and the folks at Case took note of that. So they've been very kind to me over the years, giving me opportunities. I also enjoy writing. That's part of what I enjoyed doing in college as well. So another one of my itches was to see if I couldn't write a book one day, and Case was happy to agree to publish that. So that worked out well. And then to go back to your introduction about some of my far-flung work, I just happened to come along at a time when Case was really expanding internationally. And so they opened an office in London, they opened an office in Singapore, and were really starting to get their brand out around the world, and kind of saw in me And I always chuckle at how I phrase this. An American that they could put in front of an international audience who would do okay and would be a point of pride for Case, right? And so that really meant a lot too, that not only could you connect with an American audience, but you could connect with people who didn't even understand what advancement was, didn't understand what we do in our work, but you could sort of see light bulbs getting switched on when you were talking to folks. So I can't thank Case enough. I can't credit Case enough for how important they've been to our profession. And I certainly sure do appreciate all the opportunities they gave me just to beat the drum about what we do in advancement in general and annual giving in particular. I wouldn't be wherever I am today, I wouldn't be there without Case.
You mentioned the expansion of Case into London and Singapore, and then your own ability to connect with audiences across the globe as you worked with that organization. Can you give us some insights into maybe some of the cultural differences that are inherent in philanthropy in different countries?
Well, it's an interesting question, and I really think at the end of the day, the only real difference is that in the U.S. we've understood the idea of annual giving and supportive education as an idea really just much longer than some of these other places. So I used to think there were cultural barriers to getting people excited about supporting education. I really don't believe that anymore. I think it's not the fault of some of these other places if they just haven't thought about the idea before and haven't, I like to say, connected the dots in their mind about the thought of raising your hand and supporting an educational institution. A lot of other countries are very philanthropic, and cultures and religions are, completely charitable, but just hadn't necessarily thought about the support of education. In some places, that's very much a government provided entitlement, or was in some places. And so, what I have seen is that the Canadians sort of realized that there wasn't anything special about American educational institutions, that they could frame that case for support just as well as we could. The Brits picked up on that, and so they started emulating the Americans and the Canadians. And then in Asia, it's been a very similar situation. I think you get to a little bit of a tipping point where it's a point of pride for, a terrific institution that we are supported by our graduates and our parents and our friends. And so, for places in the world, like let's just say Australia, where they may not have been too familiar with enjoying philanthropic support at an educational institution, if they look at what's going on in the US and what's going on in Canada and what's going on in the UK, and they say, well, we need to learn how to do that too, which isn't what they might have said 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. They just said, well, that's fine in the States, mate. But not sure that's going to work here down under. But I think, if you believe in the support of education, and I do for sure, and developing the leaders of tomorrow and all that, that's not a uniquely American idea. But I think we were the first ones to really frame the idea and frame the proposition. So what I would have previously dismissed as cultural boundaries or cultural barriers, I just think is an idea that just needed to percolate around the country a little, around the world a little bit. And I think that's something to give Case credit for too. They were they went in early to sort of start beating the drum at some of these places, is my opinion about all that.
So you work directly with higher education institutions and religious organizations, and with Case, you are able to trek across the globe, beating the drum, so to speak, of higher education philanthropy. And at some point in time, you thought it would be a good idea to actually start your own consulting company. And so, can you talk to us a little bit about how that happened?
Well, that goes back to my being very curious and my being very restless mostly. And it also probably goes back a bit to my having an accounting degree from college. So I was sort of trained as a business person, then got distracted by all the fun people were having in development and advancement offices, and with good reason. But I'll always remember I was at You mentioned Cleveland State University. There was a guy by the name of Roger Shifferly, who was a consultant we were working with for a capital campaign. And he would come about once a month to meet with the team and make sure we were kind of accomplishing all our tasks in advance of a campaign. And then at the end of the day, my boss, the vice president, and Roger and me would go out and have dinner. And I used to sit and say to Roger, boy, I sure would enjoy doing what you do. And one Saturday morning in my apartment in Cleveland, Ohio, the phone rang and it was Roger. And his consulting company was having a management meeting. And the subject came up about how they thought somebody could completely fill their time just consulting with annual giving programs. And was I interested? And no kidding, John, life has never been the same after that, because I stopped going to an office, really, although now I get to many offices in many different places over the course of a year, stopped commuting for a living, and started to just meet people all over the place. So, you know, is this nature or nurture? I don't know if it was my personality that just suited me to all the variety that comes with consulting, or have I just sort of learned how to enjoy doing that? But for whatever reason, you know, I was with the consulting firms for about 10 years, and now I've been off on my own about 14 years, longer than I was ever with a firm. And, you know, you make that leap and you never quite know if the next year will be okay. And I'm in this perpetual annual review mode. And every year I say, okay, that was fun. Let's keep going. So, and I get the additional satisfaction of exercising some of those muscles I learned in my accounting class way back when. So it's just all been really satisfying. I'm a gregarious guy. So I like meeting people. I like, you know, parachuting in and doing program assessments and getting to know the team and having a fun conversation. And then I also like going on to the next place too. So whether that's a personality flaw or what, I don't know, but it's worked out great for me. And people seem to appreciate having me over every now and then. It wound up being a good match for my skills. And I always think of the phrase that the happiest people are the ones who figure out that what they ought to be doing and what they are doing is the same thing. And that kind of worked out great for me. So I'm just trying to not screw up a good thing.
Yeah, you mentioned being a gregarious guy, and I think a lot of people enjoy the entertainment factor of Bob Burdinsky's annual giving consulting operation and the presentations you give for CASE or during the conferences that you yourself host. But can you talk to us a little bit about the challenges? We sometimes know that our jobs, regardless of how much we love them, aren't always fun and games. What types of challenges has your company faced, and how have you overcome those challenges?
I think there's people who are attracted to the idea of consulting because they just want to be seen as the expert and the old sage, right? And people hanging on every word they have to say. And, you know, there really is a lot of work to the process in just organizing your time, managing your finances, managing your travel, managing to get reports written. You know, I try to do conferences and things on the side just to be visible and just to hear what places are up to. So, you know, as a guy who already said, I like the variety. Part of the curse can be that you're the chief cook and bottle washer too. And so you need to know a little bit of a lot. And you know, if things get too stacked up on your to-do list, there's nobody to your left and nobody to your right to look at. And I still enjoy it, having just said all that. But, you know, it's not for the person who likes the structured environment, that's for sure. And, you know, I've never faced any financial challenges, but there are years when all of the work piles up and you sort of struggle to keep everybody happy at the same time. And then there might be weeks when People have just finished with Christmas or whatever, and they're not even thinking about reaching out to any consultants. And you're sort of sitting there in the middle of winter in Chicago, watching the snow pile up. So it's the contradiction that, and again, it's not really a complaint, but the challenge is just that you have to know how to do a little bit of a lot. I had to learn web pages. I had to learn Eventbrite. I had to learn, you know, how to sign contracts to hold conferences in locations. I literally bought a binding machine for my office because I got tired of going to Kinko's to get reports printed and bound all the time. So it's just, I sort of equate it to building a wall brick by brick by brick. And at some point you say, boy, that's a pretty impressive wall, but you can remember that, you know, each brick that went into that wall to sort of help you finish the project. And it's a perpetual work in progress. You know, we're in the middle of a podcast, which didn't exist not all that long ago. And, you know, now I need to sit and think about, am I underexposed on podcasts? Am I overexposed on podcasts? Do I even know how to make a podcast? So I think, and I say this about annual giving too, right? That it's kind of the riddle that you never quite solve, because just when you think you've figured out how phone-a-thons are going to be your retirement, all of a sudden people stop answering the phone and we need to figure out how else we're going to engage with them. And giving days happen and crowdfunding happens. So again, this might be the flaw in my personality, that I've just always been attracted to the riddle. And I think the challenge in being in business for yourself is that something else is going to pop up that you haven't seen before. And just when you think you've figured this all out, there's a new thing to figure out. But so far, so good.
So you've managed nonprofit organizations, you've managed higher education institutions, fundraising operations, you've received the highest honors from CASE for excellence in teaching, and essentially leading the way for a lot of other countries in terms of developing their fundraising acumen in higher education. So can you talk to us a little bit about what attributes make a successful industry leader?
Well, I think, first of all, you got to have fun. And I was just thinking this last night. So I'm trying to upload session topics onto a website for a conference, right? And I'm chuckling to myself that if I didn't enjoy doing this, you know, putting on a show, putting on a conference, why would I be sitting there at 9:30 at night playing with a website, right? So I think first and foremost, and this is true whatever career you're in, you know, it's got to be fun, because I think you got to be willing to do it even when other people in their right mind, you know, might have stopped and gone to bed or thrown in the towel. And so I always have a good time doing this. I think related to that is, at least in my work and in our work, I think you got to be curious. And again, you can't say, well, you know, we just perfected how to do a mailing, so I think we should just keep doing mailings. You know, we don't have that luxury. And if you're not curious, then I don't think that's easy, you know, trying to innovate. And, you know, I've written 3 books called Innovations in Annual Giving, just because I'm so curious to see who's up to what and what's the next new thing that I need to know about. And I think that serves you well in any profession, you know, just to be interested in seeing what's the next new idea for this. And we understand how to do this, but what don't we know that we don't know, right? So I think curiosity is a big part of it too. I think those two things, as much as anything, you got to have fun, and at least in advancement work. And I think this is true for, you know, whether you're asking for an annual gift or whether you're asking for a $1 million gift. I think that curiosity really comes through when you're talking to all the people that we network with in our work. People can smell out a faker from a mile away, right? And so unless you can have a conversation about $1 million and really be sincerely interested in why somebody wants to make a gift like that and what their connections are with your institution, and how did they get where they are, you know, I don't think you can fake that kind of interest and that kind of curiosity. So I've always thought that trait serves me well, even though I drive my wife crazy because I am always wanting to go check out something when we're walking or traveling or whatever. I can't help myself, but I think in our work, it's a really good skill to have.
As a leader, that curiosity and enjoyment for the job can help develop a great culture in your organization and also develop a great culture within the company that you're starting. And what advice would you give to entrepreneurs looking to start their own company in the fundraising space?
Well, yeah, did I just say have fun? Starting your own business isn't guaranteed fun, but my time, I told you about how Case, I think, was fortuitous timing. The other thing that worked in my favor, and I told you I'm older than the internet, and my career is older than the internet. Around the time when I made the decision to go off on my own, web pages were still a new thing, and just as importantly, Google was a new thing. And so, if you wanted to hire an annual giving consultant, years ago, you would hire one of the big consulting firms because they had a team and they had an advertisement on the back of Case Currents, and that was how you sort of found people that did consulting. Well, web pages come along and Google comes along, and lo and behold, I figure out that I can create my own web page, and lo and behold, I figure out that you can type annual giving consultant into Google, and up comes my name as the first response. Not brilliant, just ahead of my time, really, or an early adopter. Again, that was one of those kind of fortuitous moments that where I might have otherwise spent my career with a consulting firm, and nothing against consulting firms, but I had the ability to kind of see if I could figure this out on my own just because of the timing I had, where one person hanging out their shingle could really be found a lot easier than anybody could before. That case directory I was telling you about, that was just as much of a single resource to find consultants in a way. So all of a sudden the game changed, and it gave me a space to go have a visibility that I otherwise wouldn't have had. And then when I started doing things for Case, that gave me some additional credibility too. So to answer the question, I think I've ticked off a couple of things there. Is just understand the environment that you're getting into and understand sort of what the marketing is going to be. What causes people to look at you as a thought leader in the field? I think writing the first book I did for Case was one of the smartest things I could have done because it really was true back then. I mean, we could argue the importance of a book these days, but is it a blog? Is it a podcast? Or what? But back then, people really did look at you differently if you had a book with your name on it, and so that was a really great credential. But I would think about what does that look like in the space that you're trying to be in, and then anything else in business. Who's the target audience? How do I connect with the target audience? I've sent out more email newsletters than I can count anymore, just to beat the drum with folks. I got another very nice opportunity, gosh, about 20 years ago, when the guy who had been moderating Fundlist asked me if I wanted to take it over. He was retiring, and just out of the blue, he thought I had the right sort of conscience or personality to take the torch from him. And that's been extremely useful, in part just to see who's up to what, but also just occasionally to pop up and remind people that I'm still here and still doing the things I do. And I've tried to be very respectful with Fundlist over the years to not be too self-promoting there. And I think some people react the opposite way, that oh my gosh, there's Bob Burdensky. He actually posted something.
Over the course of your career, you've been a benefactor of organizations that have been early adopters of either technology or new ways to frame ideas or expanding into different markets. Can you talk to us about some of the most significant disruptors in the fundraising space that you've experienced over the years, and how have organizations successfully adapted to those disruptors?
Well, I think they're fairly obvious in annual giving in particular. I think in a way, the higher you go up the fundraising pyramid, I think if you're asking somebody for $1 million, I'm not sure that that process is all that different from what it might have been 25 or 30 years ago. I think we're probably getting smarter at identifying who those people are, but I think the people who have those skills, it's the same sort of qualities that I think you would have found in somebody back when I was getting into our profession. In annual giving, we've had no such luxury, right? I mean, like we were saying, you have to kind of keep looking over your shoulder to see what's coming next. I think I was there for the early adopting of the phone-a-thon way back in the, gosh, early 90s, I think. In my time at Cleveland State, the guy I used to work for, he was one of the real early adopters at having a computerized phone room. So I actually had a front row seat talking to some of the vendors and some of the institutions that were the first ones to jump all in with the phone-a-thon. And, Jonathan, that's been central to a lot of our annual giving fundraising success, certainly in the education realm for a long, long time, and with good reason. And we all raised a lot of money doing it. But you got to look over your shoulder, right? And all of a sudden, along comes caller ID, and along comes cell phones, and along comes people saying, "Don't call me anymore," or not even answering the phone, and not just when we call, but when anybody calls. And so that put us in the position of what's the next new thing. That's a mighty big disruptor. But that has also opened the door for what we're doing in the online realm and the digital realm and giving days and crowdfunding. I'm not sure a lot of that would have been so readily possible if for not because of the fact we had to find some other window to connect with people in the absence of calling them up on the phone. So I always remember the ice bucket challenge a few years ago when that one kid dumped a bucket of ice on his head and challenged his friends and relatives to do the same thing and give to support the ALS Foundation. And before you knew it, they had raised $115 million. I think that wound up being a disruptor in terms of showing the rest of us just how powerful video and online fundraising and Facebook could be as resources. So I think that was maybe not the ice bucket challenge, but certainly the arrival of all that social media and all that digital capability has been a big disruptor that I think we're still getting our fingers around. People have such mixed feelings about Facebook, but I think Facebook has demonstrated the availability of all that digital information about folks and all that data that tells people what really floats your boat as interests and about your background. And, I think you have to take all that with sort of a caveat that things may get legislated out of our hands. But I think the demonstration that Facebook has provided of how you can find an audience for your rugby team or find an audience for your formal garden or find who knows who within a class at your university is just such a powerful resource. And I would include LinkedIn in this too, in making our Razor's Edge employment information immediately outdated at most of the places I get to because you've got all this self-reported information on LinkedIn. So those are just a couple. I think the arrival of the phone-a-thon, the departure of the phone-a-thon, the arrival of social media, I think video is going to become only more prominent. I'm sitting here in Chicago where Verizon is bragging they've now got 5G internet, which means I can download something like The Sound of Music movies in 3 seconds. How does that transform what we do? The phrase digital engagement officer is becoming a thing that I can have a person-to-person conversation looking at somebody without ever leaving the office to do it. But again, it goes back to where we started this chat. It's all that endless riddle of annual giving. And those are just some of the disruptors I've seen. And I've got complete confidence there's going to be a steady stream of more disruptors as we go in the future. What I never lose faith with, though, is the generosity of people and the power of philanthropy. So it's our challenge to figure out how to connect with them, but and what channel, you know, we're telling our story on. But I do think philanthropy endures, and in fact, it's one of those things that makes me even more grateful for the profession that we're in. That you know, sometimes things in the world these days can be a little depressing, and it's philanthropy that makes me smile in spite of everything else. You know, people still raise their hand and want to make a gift to a good cause, and that makes me smile.
The disruptive factors that you talked about certainly have been earth-shattering for advancement offices across the country. Can you talk to us a little bit about what your vision for the future of advancement is and how the profession will evolve?
There's one big thing that bothers me a lot these days, that I think there's a little bit of an institutional thinking that if we could invest more money in an annual giving program, let's say if we could invest money in creating an annual giving program, or if we could just hire another major gift fundraiser, why wouldn't we just hire another major gift fundraiser? And, you know, I start to worry about philanthropy driven by the top of the pyramid, right? I don't want the 1% shaping our institutional mission and getting all of the love from our organizations. And making institutional decisions, you know, kind of on the basis of that tippy top of the pyramid. I think it still is a point of pride at a lot of places that this is about a community, that it's about our broad base of support. I think Michigan's last big capital campaign bragged rightfully that 95% of our gifts were $5,000 or less. But I don't think that good feeling endures unless we sort of keep celebrating it. And as long as it remains an institutional priority and a good validation of an institution's mission. So I think the next evolution, the next sort of fault line is going to be this kind of push-pull between, do we even worry about a broad base of support, and do we even worry about annual giving? I want to write an article, by the way, called Little Orphan Annual Giving, so don't steal my title. So do we just decide that's just more work than it's worth? Let's just hire another major gift fundraiser. And if we do, then does that become a little bit of a self-fulfilling thing that, you know, people look at us funny if we ask for a little gift because they don't see the value in that anymore. And I see that at some of the places I visit. And I think part of it is because we have yet to really replace the phone-a-thon. And so, you know, we're losing money calling people and we haven't quite figured out what's the 2.0 version of that. So I think it would be wrong to diagnose the patient, you know, and say nobody wants to make an annual gift anymore if it's our fault that we just haven't connected with them and told our story. Then in the meantime, we sell ourselves on the idea of just hiring another major gift officer. So I keep beating the drum and keep hoping that that broad base, that statement of community support continues to be meaningful to a lot of causes. And that in the meantime, we're going to figure out, you know, giving days and crowdfunding and video and, you know, all the stuff that's going to reconnect us with those audiences. And I know that, you know, kids are graduating with a lot of debt and maybe there's a segment of the population that just can't be as philanthropic as their parents and their grandparents might've been. But again, I still have faith in philanthropy, that give of your own means, right? And even if this isn't your grandfather's annual fund, I still think there's plenty of opportunity to raise your hand and show your support. That's what keeps me going.
Well, I'm sure I speak for all advancement professionals out there in that we hope you continue going for as long as possible. Bob, thank you for the invaluable insights into your career as a professional fundraiser and consultant. If you want to hear more from industry-leading fundraising professionals, be sure to visit advancementdaily.com, where you'll be able to access all of our interviews as well as our archive of articles and publications. Happy fundraising!